everybody. This meeting will be recorded and the sound recording subsequently made available via the Council's website. Please also note that under the new openness of local government body regulations 2014, that other people may film, record, tweet or blog from this meeting. The use of any images or sound recordings is not under the Council's control. Thank you. Before I start, could I welcome Colin Hamilton, our latest councillor, so welcome.
Thank you very much.
And we will be gentle with you today, but only today. Right, apologies please.
I've had apologies from Councillor Rollings, Councillor Murphy and Councillor Gaskill.
Thank you very much. Any disclosures of pecuniary and personal interest?
1 minute.
Oh, sorry, missed one. Minutes of previous meeting. Is it all right for me to sign these as a true and correct record? Yes?
Yep.
Thank you very much. I've got to say that word again now, haven't I? Disclosures of pecuniary and personal interests. Are there any?
No.
Declaration of party whip. There's no. Questions on the scrutiny committee procedure 11.17. Are any questions submitted?
No.
Thank you very much. Right, so item six, please. I would like to welcome Alison Simmons and Ian Olwyn, who I don't think I've met before. Hello, Ian.
Hello, hi.
Thank you very much. So policy that's being spoke about today is aspects of the housing revenue account and the business plan. Olwyn is the financial guru for this, and Alison Simmons is just the pretty face, I think. No. will tell us the strategy, the management strategy.
Well,
I well you would, yes. Alison.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Thank this you is a joint report from the Head of Landlord Services, who is unfortunately unable to attend tonight. But the purpose of the report is to review the progress to deliver the Housing Revenue Account Business Plan 2014-2044 and the Housing Asset Management Strategy 2014-2019. These were both approved in 29th of September 2014. So the Housing Revenue Account is the business plan that identifies the level and sources of funding available to deliver the priorities and provide the housing services to tenants and leaseholders. It's a long-term plan covering the next 30 years. The business plan updates the previous business plan in February 2012, and the Housing Asset Management Strategy provides the strategic priorities for maintaining and developing the housing stock. Financial modelling and capital capacity, this has all been completed by the Chartered Institute of Housing, and this was following the subsequent self-financing of council housing stock. The council at that point took on a self-financing debt of £79 million with 30 years to repay that debt. The debt cap, as you'll see from the graph, slowly starts. It's very small currently, but it gets bigger as we go through the 30-year period. Treasury management was put in at the point of obviously making the borrowing for the loan, and the rates were fixed at the date of borrowing. The borrowing has been taken out at different rates over a staggering period of 30 to 40 years. And in the next 30 years, we've either got the choice when we get to a point for that particular borrowing to either repay the debt or to then refinance the debt. We still need the money to take forward. Now, since we took on the self-financing debt, a number of national policies have changed, and that's had an impact on the HRI business plan. So our current business plan does require reviewing, but we need to wait for a number of things to come forward for us to ensure that we're taking the assumptions and sensitivities into putting the new business plan together. But pages 3 to part of page 4 provide the details of the subsequent changes that have happened since the business plan was approved. So the Welfare Reform and Work Act required a reduction in rents for a period of 4 years, so that rents were frozen at 2015-16 baseline. This policy relates to a possible impact of £300 to £400k per annum. So obviously that's an incremental amount, because each year you're reducing it.
Yeah, it's not just frozen, if it goes down 1% from that original frozen figure each year. So, yeah, so over the 4 years it will be 4% lower than it was at the start.
Right, okay.
Yeah, and then that's an incremental impact. Yeah.
Sheltered accommodation wasn't included in the first year because we still had our rental increase, but from year two that has also had the same impact as Ian has just alluded to. In October this year, the DCLG set out a proposal to increase social rents going forward from 2020 by CPI plus 1% for 5 years. So again, that gives us a bit more, I suppose, security in relation to the rental income we'd be getting, that it will start to slowly increase. The sale of higher value voids, which was linked to the extension of right to buy to housing associations in relation to the replacements, and the Housing and Planning Act introduced a duty on local authorities to consider selling our higher value homes so that money would become available for the government then to redistribute for the housing associations to rebuild and replace their units. This, we're still awaiting the regulations and how this will actually work, because it's whether we could be forced to sell the properties or whether we could then just give the financial amount that's required and still maintain our stock. But again, we'd have to take into consideration whether we could afford to do both. It's looking now that this won't come into play until next April. So again, we're waiting for a bit more information in relation to that. Universal credit is rolling out in April, and the report details the impact this will have, and it is expected that the rent arrears will increase and rent collection rates will reduce. With universal credit, there's no benefit for the first week, and some claims are taking between 6 and 8 weeks, so there's a delay, therefore, in benefit being received. We're working through a task and finish group across the Leicestershire districts and boroughs, which is attended by the Head of Customer Experience, to look at the impacts of where Melton has rolled it out, so that we can learn the lessons, and also to make sure that there's training in place, not only for staff but also support for people, because all the applications have to be made online, so it's not like it is currently, so there's a complete culture change in the way applications are made. The last item is in relation to mandatory use of fixed term tenancies. Now, when this was introduced by the Localism Act, the council made a choice at that time that they would retain lifetime tenancies. In the Housing and Planning Act, there's now a requirement that local authorities have to have fixed term tenancies of between 2 and 5 years. So again, we're still waiting the regulations to state exactly how we need to take this forward, and the date when this would come into existence. But what we will be doing is reviewing our current strategy and policy, and we'd have to look at how we actually administer that, because what it would mean is we'd need to carry out reviews according to the length of tenancy to see if people should still remain in that tenancy or move on to alternative accommodation. So there will no longer be lifetime tenancies, although there can be some exceptions. So again, once we get the regulations, we can look at how that policy will work for Charnwood. So moving on to the housing asset management strategy, at the bottom of page 4, it clearly sets out the objectives that were approved by Cabinet, obviously to maintain our existing stock, which we do through the business plan, ensuring that works are carried out not only to meet the decent home standard, but the Charnwood standard that's been approved, and investment that's been positive in line with the priorities, to ensure that the general needs stock, housing stock, does meet non-decency. There are still some work to do in relation to shelter schemes, which is why we're carrying out a review. The second item in relation to new build, and this is the objective to build or acquire properties. We are taking that forward currently by looking at how we can use our right to buy receipts, and it's more about acquiring than actually building, but we are looking at both options. And then garage sites. Do you want me to go into more detail about the right to buy sales and how we can use that money, or it does link?
I would like to know how we can move that money. I was just about to write a question down on that.
Okay, so with the right to buy receipts, we can retain these, but whatever we do with the money, we can only buy 30% off a property. So the council then has to top up the remaining 70%. So we've signed an agreement with the Secretary of State to do a one-for-one replacement. So therefore, every time we accept a pot of money, that it can only be used for 30% of the purchase. So we need to know that the HRA can stump up the other 70%. So for this financial year, we've got just over 300,000 to spend, and we've identified two properties which we're hoping will go through the process. I can't give you any details in relation to the properties. And then for next year, we're looking at just under £2 million that will be available to go out and purchase. And what we'd be looking at is properties that meet the two-bed housing needs, because that is what the demand is, but also looking at how we can look for funding for interim temporary accommodation in relation to the requirements of the Homeless Reduction Act. So we're taking that forward. If we don't spend the money in the given time period, we have to give the money back plus 4% interest above the base rate. So there is a real driver to make sure that we do spend this money. So we're on this one to make sure that we do spend the money available. This one does, the right to buy receipts does link into the next one, which is in relation to our garage sites. Again, this explains the number of garage sites, basis report, etc., and obviously the number of people on the waiting list. But our supply doesn't meet the current demand, so we do need to look at what we can do with some of the garage sites. But we're, what we're also trying to do is to look at this in relation to whether they could be redeveloped and whether we could use the right to buy receipts to do part of that redevelopment. We were all, once we've got to the stage where we have got the site that we'd like to develop, we will be doing consultation. We have got five sites which we're currently looking at, which again I can't provide details of until we've done various pieces of work in relation to the feasibility and viability of the schemes. But we will be going out to consultation as and when we get to that point. The next aspect of the report is the choice-based lettings housing allocation policy. We've recently reviewed and had our policy approved in October. What we're trying to do is make the best use of the stock, which is why we've made the various changes to the policy. We currently have 2,618 people on the waiting list, and this last year we only had 456 lets in that time period. And to date this year, we've only had 332 lets. So again, the shortfall is considerable, which is why obviously we need to be looking at new build acquisitions and use of other sites, etc., to what we can do with those. Sheltered housing review. We are looking at all the sites. We have got a project board and a project team. And what we've done through that is we've agreed an action plan of how we look at them. We've got a criteria to make sure that it meets a particular size standard and what should and shouldn't be in a scheme. We base that on Riversdale, which is obviously a scheme that we've just refurbished, we've got additional units. And we've got to the point now where we've done the desktop exercise, so we fully understand where the scheme is, what facilities are within the area. And obviously the demand for that particular scheme, and then we've got a CRIDE standard that we've then assessed them against. And all we need now is for the technical experts to go out and check that our desktop exercise is correct before we take some recommendations back to the board to make decisions on the shelter schemes. And then the last part of the report is what we're doing in relation to our council stock and reducing carbon emissions and improving the energy efficiency and standards of council housing stock, which again we've listed the work that we've completed and the work that we intend to complete. And that's it now. If you've got any questions?
Loads. Thank you very much, Alison. Renata.
Thank you. One little one on the garage aspect. I'm surprised to hear we've got so many garages, but I'm just reading that line of 205 of these are currently vacant and 185 applicants are on a waiting list. So why aren't they marrying together? Because I would have thought that would have given you a few spares and they'd all live happily ever after with their garages.
Because I think what we've tried to explain is the remoteness of the site to where people live now, and they don't want their car parked in a car park that's somewhere, say it's in a cul-de-sac, it's at the bottom, they want their car in front of their property. So again, it's where the sites are located, and where people actually want garages aren't necessarily where our garages are.
Yeah.
So
could be another village or something, so they're like, you know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the fact that the numbers are almost identical, there's only 20 different, shows that they're inappropriate, doesn't it? So that people won't object to them being demolished.
Think it's part of the consultation, because there might be 20 garages, but if 10 people have got or want them, the garages, it's then how we look at that and whether within the particular area there is somewhere where we can provide additional alternative parking to where they've currently got. So it's all those things we need to consider, because we can't just say, right, you've had your garage, you're not having it now because we want to develop. We need to do part of the consultation.
But there might be a few left that still want them.
Yeah. And then it's how we, you know, deal with that. So we need to take all that into consideration.
This has been a win-win in Thurmaston. There's two garage sites. One, antisocial behaviour was being there. The site was awful and used as a tip site as well. And then it had been taken over and it's got two bungalows on it now, on one particular one and one on the other. So it was successful in Thurmaston. Luke?
Sorry, I'm struggling to understand the concept of project capacity available. If I haven't understood the graph, in 2014 it's about 85,000. 2024, it's about 28,000. What does that mean?
Sorry, you're looking at
the chart. I'm looking at the graph on page 2 and I'm struggling to understand it.
Okay. That's fair enough. The top line, which is a straight line, you see the back line, that's the council's debt cap, and that's set by the CLG.
So that's the maximum money we can borrow.
They're not allowed to borrow more than that.
Fine.
And over time, we borrowed around £79 million for the self-financing, and we've also borrowed some internal loans to fund capital programmes that we've already spent. And over time, they're going to be repaid.
So the graph
as it's like drooping down. What that's really saying is, if you think of like your credit card bill at home, you've got how much you've spent that month on your groceries or whatever, and you've got a credit limit of how much you can spend, and basically that's the capacity to borrow more money.
So 78,000 you mentioned plus a bit more.
Sorry, it's there is a missing naught on there. That's all million.
I said it's 80,000, it's 80 million, is it?
It is, yes, yeah.
So in year three, which is where we are at the moment, it's about 82 million that we're borrowing, is that right?
Yes, yeah, it is, yeah. And we've got to roughly around £8 million that we could borrow.
And you go on up and bump your ceiling, and then the plan is gradually
I mean, to be honest, this was done in 2014, and we're now in about the year three or four. We're not bumping the ceiling because of what's happened within the council's budgets each year. We've not needed to borrow the money to fund the capital programme or more money, so we have got more capacity than that graph. Just by it's millions, but it's not great scheme of 80 million.
So how does that relate to the 92.46 million referred to in the paragraph above?
That's in relation to the amount of work that needs to be completed to the stock to maintain the Charnwood standard between years 6 to 30. So that's over the period of time.
In a way, it doesn't particularly relate to that graph, because we fund, at the moment, we've been funding the capital programme for the last couple of years by having the capacity within revenue. So we collect the rents from tenants and housing benefits and so on. And then we spend all the money on the revenue costs, like myself and people.
So that's 92.46 is spread.
And we've been able to fund the capital programme that way rather than borrowing money.
If we're on year three at the moment, which is about where we are. What's happening between? Do we need any money between year three and year six? Or are you starting at year six or something for the first 6 years?
We're okay at the moment, but it just depends on things like the sheltered scheme and things like that, how much more money we'll be doing and funding that 70% shortfall in the right to buy receipts, that sort of thing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, I have a few questions actually. mandatory use of fixed term tenancies, you're saying you're waiting regulations from the government. Fixed term between 2 and 5 years. It's my understanding, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the government is looking to amend or has amended the Act to possibly extend up to 10 years under certain circumstances, or even longer with families with children.
Yeah, I think that's where we're waiting for the regulations to see what they allow us to do, because there could be some vulnerable client groups that we would still want to maintain lifetime tenancies.
So some flexibility around that with some criteria attached to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, is that it, Colin?
No. They're talking about the scheme will be funded via this, the new build. A simple question, you know, when will the scheme start? Will be funded via receipts, right? So if there's a start date and you've got the time to spend the money, when does this scheme come in?
What, the new build?
Yeah.
Well, the new build is in relation to build or acquire, so we've already started.
So it's now.
Yeah, like I said, we're trying to purchase these two properties before Christmas. So that we meet the deadline for that spend, and then the next lot of spend starts, well, straight away, and we've got till the end of the following March to complete the remaining money, 18, 19.
When it's happening, so it's in now. The other thing is just more a performance question. It's the reducing carbon emissions.
Yeah.
Because you quote a lot of numbers, which is good. Like, you know, you brought a further 810 council properties up to German standards, so on and so forth. Simple question, how did this perform against target? Did you have a number in mind that you were trying to improve? Did you exceed the target, or did you get just below the target or something? It's a general kind of performance question.
Yeah, I'll need to check that. I don't know that off the top of my head. I'll need to check against the target. I should have brought the HECA report with me, and then I could have given you the answer, but sorry I didn't pick that up.
That's fine.
But the HECA report is available on the council's website, so I can give you the link to that to send out with the minutes, as well as the information on the target.
So just useful in terms of, you know, if you hit your target or not or something, then the lessons learned from that. Simply that.
For the sake of the new councillor, could you explain the HECA report, please, what it stands for?
I can't remember what the initials stand for, but it's all to do with reducing carbon emissions, and we set ourselves targets each year, and we have to produce an update every 2 years, and then we have to publish that document. And it doesn't only cover council stock, it also covers what we do in relation to my team, which is the private sector housing team.
Thank you.
You've got a sentence at the bottom of page 7. Which I have read back to front and the other way round, and I can't make any sense of it. So could you explain the difference between, where are we going?
Energy efficiency
and suitability.
Fuel poverty.
Fuel poverty.
Oh, there, I found it now. The government has indicated that from 2018, the focus will shift from energy efficiency to fuel poverty.
Well, energy efficiency is more about having work done to a property to ensure that it is energy efficient. And in relation to the fuel poverty, that comes down to the cost for the individual tenant on heating their home. So in relation to continuing to support people to get the right energy tariffs, so that they're not paying over and above what they need to for their electric and gas, etc.
Oh, right. So that's so the following sentence is something that strengthens that then.
Yeah.
The government has indicated from 2000, the council's financial inclusion officers will continue to support.
Yeah.
So obviously we already do support on that.
Yeah. That's the aim of the financial inclusion officers, because when you're looking at somebody with rent arrears, you're looking at what else they're paying out as well, and making sure that they're not overpaying.
Do we advise on tariffs and
We would
the options of doing that, and are we successful at that? I mean, do we save people money now?
Again, I'll have to get that information from Peter.
The reason I ask is because obviously if we are doing that and saving people's money, that probably that could go on the website to encourage more people to come down and say, you know, we've helped Mrs. Bloggs save such and such amount of money. I think Radio Leicester do something like that, and they do it once a year, but they're always plumping on how much they've saved residents by doing it.
We're also looking currently, both in the private sector and the landlord services, in relation to collective switching, which a number of the other councils do across,
where All right.
You go into like a partner, and then various offers will come forward, and then there's reductions in the tariffs for
it's like bulk buy,
yeah,
kind of thing.
So we are looking at that, which would be another option as well to save residents and tenants money. That's the borough.
That's good. Good. Thank you. Okay.
On that point, you could also publish on the website what tenants are saving by the improvements. In the carbon emissions in all the getting up to this Charnwood standard or whatever, if you had figures on that, then that's more difficult to calculate, but it could be mentioned, and that's another feather in your cap as well, isn't it? Not just helping with getting the best tariff, but how much you're saving by the investment. Each person. So it's just a case of publicising your achievements. So well done on that. I think that's going really well.
Ted,
This is actually to Alison and Ian, and also to Democratic Services, because it, so far in this item we've had the HECA report, the HRA business plan, the housing asset management strategy. There's something from the Chartered Institute of Housing, and then there's the Welfare and Reform at Work Act 2016. So my question is can we, how difficult will it be to organise an all-member briefing on this for everyone to get a better understanding of it?
Get a better understanding of what?
All this of item, yeah, all of this, and how they all mesh together.
There was members training in relation to the business plan in 2015. Where just as the plan was approved, obviously as and when a new plan is developed, then there would be members training in relation to the HRA business plan.
The consultant who prepared the financial aspects of the we provided all the vital data and so on, and then they did the modelling, and then they came in and briefed members, and I was actually you were on that when it went at the time. We've now changed consultants because they don't do it anymore. They're not involved with IH. They're still a full organisation, but they don't have any consultants. We now use Capita Asset Management Systems, Asset Management, which is it's the same company that do the benefits and revenues, but it's a completely separate division to that. And that's basically the leader at the moment. Really, it's the main one. And we're dealing directly with those. We've been trying to update it as much as we can, you know, before going into members. We've got a newer sort of version, but until some of these national policies are in place, if the high value void came in and it was a huge amount of money, we'd have to redo it immediately then afterwards. So until we've got waiting for that to come in before we present a newer updated version, really. But we are working on it behind the scenes, that's the thing I can say.
And in relation to the Welfare Reform and Work Act, that would have been explained as part of the budget setting when the HRA business plan was approved each financial year, and the impact that was having on the rental income. So that would have all been part of the process since it came in 2016.
I think we're also waiting for the budget tomorrow. The main headlines so far have been the national budget have been about housing. So there's it's a funny meeting to have the night before, really.
Yeah.
We don't really know what's coming with that.
Can I just ask if Karen could come in on here?
Yeah. So just for the purpose of the recording, Karen Widdowson, Democratic Services Manager, and just to explain the member development programme, it is actually booked up until April at the present time, but I'm quite happy to liaise with Alison and her team to see if there's any items for the future we can schedule into the programme going forward. And you know, because there will always be some updates that members we feel would benefit from an update on things, and it can be done through the member development programme. So I will arrange with after the meeting with Alison.
Thank you. I mean, when you say, Alison, that you something was explained, could you just remind me what you said was explained?
The Welfare Reform and Work Act 2016 and the implications,
yes,
on the housing revenue account, and the fact that we couldn't increase our rental income, that would have all been part of the Cabinet process in approving the budget for that year when it was introduced.
So where could we find that now?
That will be on the Cabinet website.
And what date was that?
Well, the draft budget goes in December, doesn't it? So it would be the February. So yeah, it would be February
16.
Yeah.
It's definitely.
And the first item you mentioned was in 2015.
Yeah, the Cabinet, that was the approval.
It was a training. It was a briefing, was it?
An asset management strategy. No, that was the Cabinet report, 24th of September 15.
Oh, so it wasn't a briefing, it was a report.
Yeah.
It was a Cabinet report.
Oh, right. Yeah. So my request is for a training briefing on it. I appreciate this report, but I that's what I'm requesting, please.
Michael.
My recollection, and I can check back, but there was also a member briefing following the as part of the process of agreeing the business plan 2014-2015.
So would you be able to find that, please, and forward it on? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And I've been very neglectful as well. I should introduce you each time, and if you then could say who you are, so we get into the habit of doing it. Luke.
Luke Smith. Probably a naive question, but when it says the housing business plan identifies the level and sources of funding available. Now I can see that we've got the level we need, but I don't know where it's coming from. No simple plan suggesting, yeah, that,
well,
this shows the sources of funding available. I'm not sure where it's coming from.
This is an update on the business plan. This report isn't the business plan itself.
Yeah.
This is a report about the business plan.
Right.
So if you, I mean, that's a business plan here, and yeah, you can, I just printed this off the council website today. It'd be in there. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So in relation to the income is the rental income.
Yeah.
And then any grant subsidies we might get for any particular
service charges, things like that.
And so leaseholders would pay service charges.
Mm.
Service charge can be paid by tenants and leaseholds, and if there was any planned maintenance works, again, leaseholders would pay for that.
Thank you.
So that's the income.
Okay. Can I just ask regarding the universal credit? So does every application have to be done again as from new, or does it roll out what they're already claiming, or what benefits people already have, or is it a sort of start all over again and reclaim? It's completely start all over again.
Yeah, Addison Simmons, head of strategic and private sector housing. Yes, it is a starting again, because you've got to, when they're looking at universal credit, what they've done is they pull six different benefits into one, so you've got to be reassessed to see which part of those benefits that you would receive.
Right. Okay. And staffing wise, we've obviously allowed for this, and Brenda Seaton, chair of the committee, we've obviously employed more people for this, and we're going to be fit from running.
In relation to universal credit, that falls under the head of customer experience, and they will be putting in place the requirements, which is why they've been part of the task and finish group, so they can learn for what's happened where it's been rolled out in Melton.
Thank you very much. And my other question was, thank you for explaining the 30%, Brenda Seaton, thank you for explaining the 30% and 70%, but I note that the 30% is 300,000, but next year will be 2 million.
Can you explain that?
Alison Simmons, Head of Strategic and Private Sector Housing. The 300,000 is the 100% figure, 30% of which is right to buy receipts.
Right.
The same with the just under 2 million for next year, 30% of that is the right to buy receipts. The remainder is the top up from the housing revenue account.
Okay. And can we, could we use any money from the right to buy to renovate the houses, sheltered housing?
Ian Orwin, it has to be new, something new, that not, you can't spend it on something that you've already got. So when we did the Riddersdale project, that was, I can't remember exactly the numbers, but we could only use the funding for the four additional properties to the ones that, I think there were 25 properties,
yeah, 25,
and now
29.
We've got 29, so we could only access funding for four.
Right.
Because that's the net increase in the funding. Well, even though the whole thing was unrecognisable from the flats before and all renumbered and everything, it was, you couldn't use it on the whole thing.
Okay, thank you. Right, I don't think I've got any more questions. Anybody else got any more questions? Ted?
Councillor Parton. Earlier on, Councillor Hamilton, you asked a question, didn't you, about where you said relating a number to a target,
yeah,
and how far that was. How much of this could be tabulated into three sections in so where you've got so you can see in real time what's happened. So what's happened so far, the number, when, and also at what point in time you're anticipating to do a certain target number. How much of this could be tabulated, please?
Brenda Seaton, I don't think I understood that question.
No.
Could you repeat it, please, Ted?
Right, so there are figures here.
What page?
Well, for example, page 7.
Okay.
So you have a past and a future. So the past is updated energy performance certificate records of 438 homes. Now, we don't know whether that there was a target to do 500, but only 438 were done, or whether there was a target to do 438 and all were done.
Okay.
And we also don't know whether next year there is another 175 to be done, or whether they've all been done this year. And then going into the future, you've got, for example, increase roof insulation levels to meet current requirements, replace 326 heating units. There may be 1,000 heating units that need replacing, and we've decided in year one we'll do 326, in year two we'll do 200. So that's the point I'm trying to make. Is that any clearer?
So, yes, no, to be quite honest. Not relevant to this committee.
I understand that,
yeah,
but that could
that
go
would
to
be
performance.
Under performance.
Yeah.
So you want to, you would like to know whether it can be measured.
Exactly. That's right.
The success rate of this reducing carbon emissions.
Progress. I mean, for example, at Housing Management Advisory Board, you know, we see how many units have been completed, and whether it's in green, red or amber, and that's exactly what happens at policy scrutiny. At performance. So that's what I'd request, please.
Okay. We can request that goes to performance, and the usual route is through SMB.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Renata.
Thank you. I don't know if you've wrapped that up now. Renata Jones, Councillor Jones, whatever you want for the recording, please let me know. I was just going to pick up on that point, which I think we did have a brief discussion in the last performance meeting, about the link between performance scrutiny and policy making. And if we're here to review policies going forward, it probably is worth having an indication of how effective those policies have historically been holistically to decide whether we're still doing the right things going forwards or not. So I think Councillor Parton does make a good point there, that a hint of overall success in the policy historically will help us understand whether we're deciding whether we are approving the right things going forwards or not. I'm not sure how that's best delivered in the course of what we review here in this setting going forward, but I do think there is a good point on underlying there in the point Councillor Parton's made.
Okay. Michael, have you got any thoughts on that?
He's scribbling across.
Michael Hopkins, a couple of things. Obviously, if it's the wish of this group, you can make that that specific recommendation in relation to the carbon emissions performance that Councillor Parton was referring to. And that would be a formal decision of the group if that's what you wish to do. In terms of the wider point that Councillor Jones made, obviously some of you will be aware that there have been some discussions recently about the work that the performance panel does, and the point has been raised that may then impact on how this group and that group work together. I think probably at some point there'll be an informal discussion between the relevant chairs, and we'll try and sort of work something out. But I think that the question has been put, and I think hopefully we can come to a way of working together. I mean, the current scrutiny structure design work that the two groups sort of complement each other, but there has to be a dialogue between them to enable that to happen. And we do have regular meeting, a regular appearance by the chair of the performance panel at this group, and I think the next time that's scheduled to happen is at your next meeting, so you may wish to focus on that aspect.
I think if I can come in there, yes, we are having a meeting later on this month. But I've already spoken to Karen Middleton, sorry, Brenda Seaton, about when things are underperforming in performance, that probably then, if it's underperformed for two consecutive occasions, it should come back then to policy to find out why it has underperformed or is underperforming, and find out if there's a part of the policy that is stopping it from performing correctly. So there are talks around that at the moment, but yes, can see the point of view and the value in that, and it is being spoken about. Alison.
The details on page 7 aren't in relation to what's been completed. I probably should have put what the targets were that they were being completed against.
Yeah.
Because as you'll see, the second section tells you what we can do in the next 2 years. So there was target set, but I've obviously not given you that amount of detail. I'll ensure that the HECA report is sent to you so you can see that, because we have put in the HECA report exactly what has been completed against the relevant targets.
Okay.
And
Ted.
Councillor Parton, may I just make a point of clarification as well? Thank you very much for your assistance, Democratic Services. However, just a point of clarification, when Michael, you mentioned the figures regarding the reducing carbon emissions, what I'm trying to do is to throughout this whole subject find some figures. For example, one can go to page 5 and it says this scheme supports delivery of the corporate performance indicator K12 to increase the supply of affordable homes. So yeah, we must surely have a figure in mind, and how are we progressing towards that figure? So there are actually a range of statistics in here that I think would be useful to all members. I wasn't just thinking specifically of reducing carbon emissions. I use that as an example.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Michael.
Michael Hopkins. The obviously, if there's a reference to a KPI in there, that already is a goes to performance panel. If I were to make a suggestion, perhaps it might be that if the group was happy with the principle of what's being suggested, so probably on this the breadth of it, that there are various elements in the report that could be included in the information that performance scrutiny panel scrutinises, perhaps if you were happy to, then officers could work with the chair and councillor Parton to identify which specific ones would lend themselves best to that, and that could form your recommendation to the scrutiny management board.
Okay, happy to.
Thank you.
Right, have we got any more questions, please, Keith?
Going back to universal credit, on top of page 4, Councillor K. Harris, it says rent arrears will increase and rent collection rates will reduce. Is that a temporary thing because of the 6-week delay, or is that going to carry on as the nature of the beast because housing benefit is affected in general? Is that a temporary or a permanent thing?
Anthony Simmons, it would be probably a permanent thing, because if each universal credit claimant doesn't get the first week's rent, that's always going to be a debt unless the tenant has the wherewithal to actually make the difference up. As you go through the process, you're going to have different tenants that are on universal credit and maybe coming off when they find a job, and then new people coming on. So I think it's always going to have a sort of an effect. But whether it will be the same as when it started, it's dependent on how many people get back into work.
If I could ask a question, please. It's a point of clarification, please. The terms, fixed terms, 2 to 5 years and longer, if the report says so. Does that only apply to new tenants?
Yes, it would only apply to new tenants, unless the regulations state differently.
And the other one is, can we make somebody homeless? So at the end of the 2-year tenancy, and we say, well, that's it, you're out, you shouldn't have a council house anymore. How does that work? Because we are making them homeless then.
I think the way you need to look at it is that we've had somebody for a 2-year period, we would work with those people in that particular time frame, and if we got near to the end, you do a review, probably, again, depends on how we put the review process in place, but you might do that after 18 months, and if you find somebody has got the capacity, the income, etc., that they could find accommodation in the private sector, you'd work with them to help them to find that accommodation. So you wouldn't look at, right, that's it, you're out. We'd be working with people to help to find them alternative accommodation. There will be some people where last resort we might have to evict, and that could possibly be because of non-payment of rent, or that could be because of antisocial behaviour. So again, eviction is always the last resort, because obviously otherwise what happens then is they go out of one end of the service and they come back in another end of the service. So we're always trying to work, which is why we've got the financial inclusion team, why we've got tenancy support. So those people that are vulnerable, and this is what we need to bring once we've got the regulations and we can start looking at the review process, how we can assist those that we would want to end the tenancy, help them to find alternative accommodation.
So that support is always going to be...
That would be a cabinet decision as to the 2 years, the 5 years, and what things we take into consideration as part of the review process, like we've got now when we made the decision that we would continue with lifetime homes. And again, depending on the regulations, if you can set criteria outside of that, again, cabinet would approve what the criteria is for those that could have, as the council has already alluded to, a 10-year tenancy or a lifetime tenancy. You wouldn't look at if you place somebody in shelter to end their tenancy after 2 years, 5 years. From the previous regulations, when it was brought in for the Localism Act, their tenancy stayed lifetime. Again, I don't know if that is going to change because until we get the regulations.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any more questions, please?
Alison. No. No. Right. Michael.
So I think what I've got is that there aren't any specific recommendations that you want to make in terms of the policy documents.
No.
There is some additional information that you've asked for from Alison and from Democratic Services, which we can provide, and that you wish to make a recommendation to Scrutiny Management Board that it considers adding certain performance indicators drawn from this report to the work programme of the Performance Scrutiny Panel, and that the best way of identifying those would be sort of between officers, yourself and Councillor Parton.
Yep. That's an agreed reference. Thank you very much. Thank you, Alison.
Thank you.
Thank you. Item 7, a regeneration economic development strategy. And this is a review and a progress report. Welcome, David Hankin.
Thank you, Chair. I'm David Hankin. I'm the team leader for economic development and regeneration. A title which is longer than the team. There are two of us. Everything I say tonight is within the context of that level of resource. Clearly, the corporate plan makes a major commitment to creating a strong and lasting economy, one of our three headline priorities from the corporate plan. And the service plan takes its cue from that, from the corporate plan, in committing to the preparation or a refresh of our economic development and regeneration strategies. And that work is in progress, and we came to you back in July to give you an initial heads up as to what we were going to be doing. And on that evening you called for us to come back tonight and explain what progress we had been making. So in terms of that earlier report, we set out that there were five discrete components to this project. There was the strategic context, followed by an analysis of just what the charm of the economy is, what makes us tick here in this part of the world, what should be our strategic priorities going forward, and then on the basis of that to develop some key performance indicators to measure our progress against those strategic priorities, and followed with the framework for monitoring and governance of that process. So we're making progress on the strategic context, and work is ongoing within the team to gather an understanding of the degree to which major pieces of government policy and documents emerging from the Leicester and Leicestershire Enterprise Partnership, the degree to which they provide a structure. It's always the case that it's like working on shifting sands. That's almost as Ian Elwin said earlier. We're expecting a major announcement tomorrow in the budget in terms of what the government's new industrial strategy will have to say. So that may well also, will influence what our strategy will have to respond to. It will also influence what the Enterprise Partnership does in terms of refreshing its own strategic economic plan. So we will endeavour to capture the new strategic directions which are emerging from those key pieces of national legislation, or national guidance, I should say. The second element is getting to an understanding of just what the charm of the economy is, and it's a multifaceted beast. And each element influences each other element. So we have commissioned consultants who glory in the term of Tech4i2, don't ask me why, who have an understanding of the various data sources which help build up an understanding of just how a particular locality is performing economically. They use a matrix in undertaking that work, and they mine something of the order of 70 data sources. So not only do these people know where to find this information, they also know how to extract the nuggets that we need to better understand how things are working in Chandler. In broad terms, they cover six areas, six very closely interrelated areas: people and population growth, employment, looking at figures for levels of employment in different sectors and how they're performing, what business activity there is, how many businesses there are, how many are growing and expanding, how many are declining and disappearing off the map. Skills and education, infrastructure that's required, the housing, the employment sites, and other things which emanate from movement and migration or travel between home and work. And then the overall economy, the level of gross value added that's achieved through the products of the work in the district. So our consultants have presented their report fairly recently, so we're still digesting what some of the advice and recommendations they've come forward with. But it's the first platform that we've had for some time. We're beginning to understand just what it is that constructs the Charnwood economy. With that work, we'll be moving on towards the strategic priorities. The first step of that exercise is the stakeholder workshop. That has now been scheduled for next Monday. So we will be meeting then with colleagues from other departments in the council, colleagues from County Hall, hopefully colleagues from the Enterprise Partnership, several councillors, and a group of local business representatives who work with us through the Charnwood Together Economy and Skills Group. And that will include people from the college, not the university, to ensure that we have people familiar with the skills side of the work. That work then will lead through to the preparation of an initial draft, which we would hope to be able to consult stakeholders on early in the new year, with a view to progressing towards a final report to Cabinet in March, and the adoption at that point of a new refreshed strategic economic plan regeneration strategy. Thank you, Chair. I'm happy to take any questions you may have.
Thank you. I've got two, if I could start the ball rolling, please. So the consultants, obviously you're still going through the results, and I note you said they offer advice, and I've got a question mark there. So they don't just tell you the results of the reports that are written, but they'll offer advice?
Probably advice was the wrong word. They're effectively brought in to mine those data information sources and tell us what the key trends and issues are.
Right.
They pose some questions for us. Probably advice is the wrong word, but in those questions they are suggesting that there are issues which we might want to look at more closely.
Thank you. As I say, I thought advice was probably
yes,
wrong there.
Poor choice of word.
Yeah. And the other one was your stakeholders workshop. It sounds very Loughborough based, rather than Charnwood. Is that just my perception of not being Loughborough or what?
I'm trying to picture the faces around the table.
Yeah.
Certainly from the Economy and Skills Group, we draw representation from far beyond Loughborough. Necessarily, Loughborough College and Loughborough University are based, of course, in Loughborough. Other than that, the officers who are attending clearly represent the whole of Charnwood.
Yeah.
And other officers represent Leicester and Leicester and Leicestershire. So.
I was looking more at the business sector, because obviously they're going to have different views than a Loughborough-based business.
Those who've intended to come, I have to say, none of them are domiciled in the southern part of the borough. And I might add that we've in terms of that economy and skills group, we have struggled to retain representation from across the borough. So right. if you are aware of business contacts from other parts of the borough who might be interested in getting engaged in Trauma Together, because this is the beginning of a journey, not the end of it, then we'd certainly like to know about them. And I'm sure we could make, we might not be able to manage anything by Monday.
No.
In terms of future meetings of the Economy and Skills Group, we were certainly interested in recruiting from a broader pool than we do at the moment.
So where do you recruit from then?
Part of the problem has actually been knowing who is here in Charnwood. And we've been trying for several years to engage with business. It can be amusing at times. As soon as they know you're from Charnwood, the dialogue tends to end, because their main contact with Charnwood is a business rates demand once a year.
Right.
And there isn't always an appreciation of just what range of services we can offer. That is something which we are only recently beginning to work on, to raise the profile of Charnwood as a facilitator for business development, etc. And we're beginning to appear at trade fairs and business events in order to raise the profile of Charnwood. So it's about creating a happy coincidence where representatives from business come along to those meetings, meet us, we discuss with them, we make explain exactly what it is we can offer, and from that we look to build a more profitable relationship with business.
I realise with a team of two, it's quite difficult to raise the profile, but I think it's a thing that you need to do, and to build the basis and then build upon that.
I think that's a key part of our strategy, and it's been a key part of our work recently, has been the creation of the new In Charnwood branding, which we are beginning to roll out as part of this effort to engage more effectively with business. So we have recently been along to we've been heavily involved in the Leicester Business Festival, and have used that to best advantage to make contact with businesses. But it still isn't easy, I have to say. We do need to find any and all mechanisms to engage with businesses, and if councillors acting as ambassadors for their communities are able to put businesses in contact with us, then we welcome that.
Okay, thank you. Renata.
Thank you, Chair. Councillor Renata Jones. First of all, I'm not a Loughborough councillor, so building on the point expertly raised by our Chair, when is this stakeholder meeting, and where is it, and can I go? Would be a question as a non-Loughborough councillor.
It is next Monday. It's here. I see no reason why you couldn't come along. We've catered for more than are able to come, so there will be vacant seats. So if you wish to join us, then I'm sure you're very welcome.
What time, and is it this room?
Can I drop you a line?
Absolutely.
I'll give you the details. Yes.
Thank you.
Right, has anybody else got any questions? Oh, sorry, Ted. I've got your name down here as well. Councillor Parton.
Correct. David, I was struggling whilst you were talking to really understand the reason for hiring the consultants to collect the data they did, but in your most recent explanation about businesses' unwillingness to engage with the council, it sort of semi-answered it. But in terms of
that,
sorry,
not entirely that. The main reason for bringing consultants in is that there are a vast range of information sources. I mentioned there are 70 sources mentioned here. Just knowing where they are and how to manipulate them when you get to them. For example, there's a website called Nomis. It's an Aladdin's cave of information. And if you know how to navigate your way around that system, you can mine a lot of information. But if you're a novice, you can easily get lost, make the wrong assumptions, search the wrong database. So these, the particular skill and ability these people bring is the knowledge that these interactive databases exist and how to navigate their way through them to get the information which is most reliable. I don't want to make a big issue of businesses not wanting to talk to us. That isn't really the case. They're busy people, we need to be able to offer them something positive in order to gain their time, and we're still working on that positive offer, I think.
What percentage of the business in Charnwood do you think is already engaging with you? Trying to tease out what the scale of the problem.
Very few is the answer.
Are we talking a very small percentage?
Yes. Very good. If it was many more, the question is how we would deal with that. I think it's more a question of trying to find the channels through which they can engage and where we can be responsive.
So therefore, if currently a very small or a small percentage is only engaging with us at the moment, how do you envisage this process being a success and leading to engaging with the vast pool of businesses, and what would success look like?
Yes. A lot of the things we do that business doesn't necessarily recognise as helping them. So if we take inward investment, for example, then part of what we will certainly be looking at is how Charnwood can be more effective in attracting inward investment. Businesses might not see the immediate benefit of that until they start to begin the chain links with those businesses, and therefore the benefit might come several years down the line. What does success look like is always difficult in this business. A casual discussion at a trade fair might not appear to have any direct outcome, but 4 or 5 years down the line, that initial discussion may just have raised the profile of Charnwood and the line which we're pushing hard, which is that Charnwood is synonymous with innovation. That initial seed may well bring an investment 4 or 5 years down the line. So it's a lot of economic development work is effectively about raising profile, spreading the word, creating a context for businesses to come into perhaps at a later date.
Yeah. I've got quite a few questions. I'll just ask one more, Chair, if I may, please. So, finally, David, page 2, it says, and a bullet point, 2, 3 down. Development of key performance indicators to measure success in achieving the strategies, vision, and priorities. Are you looking to just have as many as necessary, or are you trying to narrow it down to 3 or 4 that you can really?
The reality is, it will be 3 key indicators. Otherwise, we spend more time trying to measure ourselves than doing things.
Oh, understood.
And it will be about trying to find indicators which do reflect on what it is we're doing. So a one which has been regularly used, and I can't see the merit of it, is local unemployment rates. It's a very easy one to measure, but there are so many factors bearing on local employment rates that what we do directly has probably little effect on that. So we've been trying to look at other aspects, other measures, which can generally measure what it is that Charnwood is actually bringing to the process, rather than the wider partnership of organisations who support business development.
Mm. Yeah.
It'll be a challenge for us.
Yeah. All right, well, thank you very much for your assistance.
Thank you. Keith.
Councillor Keith Harris. I assume that this involves all businesses, not just attracting large scale businesses to Loughborough. When I walk around the town, I see rather a lot of empty shops and businesses start up and then fail, and particularly food outlets. I was wondering if we've got all this information from the point of view of a small business struggling in their first years to keep going. What's in it for them? How could they be helped to survive those early difficult years where they might close down because they can't pay the business rates or whatever? There's a lot of information here. They would want to know what's in it for me.
The strategy is not just about attracting major inward investment. It will be about supporting all business. And by far and away, the biggest number of businesses in Charnwood are of 10 people and less. So they are significant employers. In terms of what this strategy will offer, that rather depends on what council wants it to offer at the end of the day. So in terms of this particular piece of work, I think it unlikely that it would bring forward specific business support incentive packages, but it might suggest that that's something that the council might look at more closely. So it's an area where I think, I said earlier, this is the beginning of a journey rather than the end. It won't have all the answers, but at the end of the day, it's open for this council to take such action as is within its powers to support businesses, and the sort of things you're suggesting are amongst that menu of opportunities and that menu of support packages that could be offered.
Thank you.
Colin.
Colin Hamilton. Touching on what others have already said about engaging stakeholders, is there a value in having a structured stakeholder engagement plan? Does that mean you actually kind of work out a plan as a list of contacts, who to contact, in particular with smaller business, other business associations, groups that you can contact via that, and then have a record of the contacts made, responses given, and just a way of just almost having a tick list to go through that you can then work on, and because that should tend to create a virtual circle, particularly because there's always one or two that will engage, and then you get feedback from them, and from that you can then build on, and if they talk to others and so on, but it'd be an actual structured plan of here's a list of initial contacts, and then use that to kind of expand and go further.
We are looking to build up that list of contacts, and it will take time. So that is a separate work stream within the team at the moment, is actually building up more intelligence about who is out there and who of those want to engage us. In the meantime, one of the faces around the table on Monday will be the representative of the Federation of Small Businesses. So we plug into that by way of their existing network structures for the time being. But in time, you're quite right. We want to develop far more intelligence around the businesses who are presently working in charge.
Because very often engaging with associations is a good way of, because they're with the contacts, as it were, of engaging with the business community at large.
It is. What we are tending to find is that there is no substitute for face-to-face.
Yes.
We've written to them all. The response rate is something like 0.001%. Again, not surprising, for the same reason earlier, as I said, businesses haven't got time to waste. So we've got to have something that is of interest and helpful to them. And that's what we're working towards.
I should imagine one thing that would be helpful coming out of the consultants' work, and then involving the colleges and university, would be the skills gap, being able to identify that, and the university hopefully to be able to offer suggestions around that.
That is without doubt one of the gaps in present provision from what we know already, that the colleges will tell us that they do have intelligence on the ground as to what local businesses, what skills they need. Businesses will tell you differently, the ones you can speak to. So we do need to, through this exercise, that is likely to be one of the key work streams that comes from this, is the, how we as a council can best support the development of the skills needed to support local businesses. And there are 101 initiatives already in that field. Mm. We won't capture them all, but it's about prioritising, I think, where we do, where we can usefully intervene to make a difference as a council.
Okay, Richard.
Thank you, Richard Shepherd. I should also, I think, declare an interest here as a county councillor, because I want particularly to refer to page one, the policy context, reference to the Sun Enterprise Park and broadband and so on. You were mentioning, Dave, moments ago about identifying what specifically Charnwood Borough Council has done. I'm interested really in how far it is possible, given there's so much partnership working, possible and I guess useful ultimately, to pull out different contributions. A point made, those of us who went to LUCEP and were addressed by John Walker a week or two ago, was about that partnership working. So I'm interested really in this task of identifying who does what, given the degree of partnership working. It may indeed be possible, but I'd be interested to hear what you say. Thank you.
Yes, we won't achieve much working alone in isolation. Mm. Most of what we achieve is done by working in partnership.
Sure.
What does Charnwood bring to that?
Yeah.
There are certain, in some cases, we can bring cash, and John graciously acknowledged the cash,
yes,
which both the county and Charnwood have brought to developing the Science Park Phase 2. The relationship that we build with business is also important. The understanding that there needs to be between local authorities and businesses, in order that we can have that intelligent discussion about the sort of things that Councillor Harris was raising. Do we want to, can we afford to offer some sort of assessments, inducements to help businesses in the early years of their development? Councillors have powers as well, of course, so we have planning powers, and developing an understanding of what it is that businesses need can be reflected in the development of the planning policies and the frameworks. There's other things, just where working together actually brings additional leverage to a process. So in the broadband case, for example, the fact that a number of authorities can come together and contribute to a project delivers better value for money just through economies of scale, but it also potentially brings better leverage in getting finance from other agencies to match fund that which we can put together. So yes, partnership is going to be another key part of what we can achieve through this particular project.
Thank you.
Okay. I know that we've sort of exchanged emails regarding the broadband, and I have two farmers that wish to diversify and to extend their businesses, and the lack of broadband that is there is, it's really impeding their development as well. And okay, we had a paper on that, but it still didn't tell us where that money would be spent, but the partnership working obviously has worked very well there. Are there any more questions for David?
No, Chair.
No? Well, that was a longer discussion than I thought it was going to be. So thank you very much, David.
You're welcome. Thank you.
For coming along. Michael.
I didn't write anything down.
Just a note.
Yes.
Thank you. You didn't write anything down.
Well.
Nothing to write. Thank you very much, David. Right, Karen.
Okay. Thank you. Karen Widdowson, Democratic Services Manager. This is on the progress with panel work. There are currently no scrutiny panels at present, and the SNB did not commission any new panels at its meeting in October. However, you may recall, and when you look back through the minutes of the last meeting, there was discussion about a possible panel about registered social landlords. And what happened was there was a scoping exercise that was undertaken with Councillor Seaton and Councillor Shepherd, and we found at that point there were other mechanisms to address any concerns that could be arising. So that's actually not gone into a panel, and there's been no recommendation to SNB, and I just wanted to confirm that's what's happened with that particular piece of work. Thank you, and that's all I was going to say on that item.
Thank you very much.
May I make a comment on that? Richard Shepherd, as I recall, at least one of the possible mechanisms for addressing the issue was during the process of formation, Alison told us, I think, at the SNB stage. Mm-hmm. Will there be a moment when the mechanisms are all finalised and in place, and a period of time when anyone concerned about RSLs can judge whether they're effective or not as mechanisms? 6 months, a year, something like that?
So Karen Widdowson, I can go through Alison again and check in with her about the two mechanisms we're talking about, the Registered Provider Developer Forum and the Registered Provider Liaison Forum, which are both chaired by the council. I understand they meet on a fairly regular basis, but they've not actually sort of that well established. So I need to check in with Alison when the next meetings are, and maybe with the mechanism is that when we know one of those meetings is coming up, that I can then email members and say, are there any concerns that need raising at that point?
Thank you. Right, can I now invite Sylvia Wright and Robbie Kerr to the table?
I'll just give us some more, yeah. So members, we've moved on to the work programme item now, and we've invited Sylvia Wright and Robbie Kerr to come along because there's a potential item that was raised by Councillor Parton in connection with the programming and booking policy of Loughborough Town Hall. So rather than we go through the rest of the items on this agenda, I thought it would be good if you could talk about the policies that are in place for bookings of the entertainment programmes and also the bookings of the hire of rooms as well at the Town Hall. Thank you.
Do we need to know why this has come to light?
It's come through because Councillor Parton under scrutiny.
What do we need to explain?
Possibly. Councillor Parton, would you like to explain why you've raised this item tonight?
Thank you. Yeah, Councillor Parton. I've raised this item because a month or two ago I read in the Echo that a TV psychic was stopping off on a UK tour, and one of her destinations was Loughborough Town Hall, and the advert, which it turned out was a generic one because I checked all of the parts of the country, it was a generic script, described it as an evening of entertainment with a serious side, because it was, I believe, called the Kisses to Heaven tour, and it described how this psychic was going to give a serious side about messages from the other side. So the issues I have with it are: was this classed as a religious event? Was it classed as entertainment? Because my problem with it is that if it was classed as a religious event, bearing in mind that we're talking about communicating with people who have died, then if it was classed as a religious event, would one expect to go to a mosque or a church or a synagogue and be charged up to £24 or £26 per person for entry? If it was classed as entertainment and it was merely an entertainment event, then wasn't this quite a sort of a rather serious matter to be held on council property under the pretense of entertainment? So then opened a broader scope of thinking, well, what is the council's policy regarding all religious events? So say, for example, a Christian preacher or a Hindu guru wanted to hold a religious event and they approached the town hall because it was a big venue. What were the rules regarding the admission for a religious event? And so then I asked for a list of all religious applications and spiritual events received by the town hall, to which I haven't received that. So therefore I'm trying to get to the bottom of this to really ascertain whether this is an appropriate forum, i.e. the town hall, to be having such a rather event that doesn't seem to sits in two areas. Does it sit in entertainment, or is it strictly a religious event?
Okay, come on. I was going to stop you there, but you did yourself, Captain. Thank you very much for explaining why.
You're welcome.
But the highlight of this was was probably that there wasn't a policy as such, or there might have been. We weren't quite sure. So over to you two now, please. If you could say your names for the...
Sylvia Wright, Head of Leisure and Culture.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting us to policy scrutiny group to actually explain the processes that we use for letting and entertainment at the town hall. Obviously we do have room hire, but we also programme shows. So there's those two things that Councillor Parton has mentioned. Firstly, may I say we have a very comprehensive operational procedures in place that have been established over a number of years with council departments and are used in conjunction with the council's financial procedure rules, health and safety, good practice, national strategies and legislation, and also our own council strategies and policies, including the children's and young people, to give an example. We have a manual which Robbie, the manager of the town hall, will take you through in a few minutes to kind of help take you through the process. But this manual provides programming staff and the letting staff, who is their day-to-day job, the necessary guidance in order to book any acts or hire spaces out within the town hall. And that is not only protecting them and the council against the risk of any financial irregularity, reputational damage, but making sure that we do adhere to legislation. Legislation does change all the time, so we need to make sure our procedures to let the town hall and hire are reviewed annually and upgraded through lessons learned or any changes in the legislation. So the manual is in place to safeguard the procedures and to guide decision making of what is appropriate to book and how we manage that, and to make sure we can do it in an equitable and meet with the Equalities Act and things like that. So if I just pass you through to Robbie, which will kind of just take you through the kind of process that we go through to give you an understanding of that.
Thank you.
Robbie Kerr. So first of all, when we're booking shows in, there's generally a circuit of reputed promoters who circulate tours, companies who have a host of acts. In the case of Sally Morgan, she has been touring public sector venues and private sector venues for many years now under the guise of, clearly advertising as entertainment.
Excuse me, was the name of the person Sally Morgan then?
Yes, sorry, that's the name of the site.
Thank you.
And there's another psychic, Colin Fry, is another one who has been doing similar tours in similar places. When we have a booking potentially, we look at the options that there are normally a group of promoters that will put their own acts forward, and they'll be quite desperate because they've got artists on the way up who want to come and use us because they're wanting to increase their capacity. The alternative, which is in the case with Ms. Morgan, is that there are artists on the way down. So she previously performed in places that were 1,600, 2,000 plus, and has worked her way down due to a kind of, I suppose, waning popularity, I guess. When we consider those factors, there's a huge body of things that goes through that process. So firstly, primarily our license, which is what we're allowed to put performances on and what those different areas of genres are. There's national legislation which goes and covers a whole host of things. So the main ones that really affect us are the Theatres Act of 1968, which is basically an act that was created to abolish censorship in the theatre and to amend the law in respect of theatres and theatrical performances, which basically means that freedom of speech is allowed to take place so long as the events aren't seen to be corrupting or depraving audiences who attend. There's also things like the Indecent Displays Act, which allows shows like Equus to exist, where there's shows with nudity, as long as they are taken away from the public eye and not put in the public place. But if it's chargeable or if people are attending through their own free will, and as long as it's advertised appropriately, then that's fine. The Public Order Act of 1986, which enforces prohibition of public gatherings on multiple grounds, including things like religious hatred and sexual orientation, and gives us right of passage to disperse and cancel any planned events if it's felt to be it's kind of going against that. Basically, what it says is if a public performance of a play is given which involves the use of threatening words or behaviour, any person who presents or directs the performance is guilty of an offence if he intends thereby to stir up religious hatred or hatred on the grounds of sexual orientation. And lastly, the 2000 Terrorism Act, which basically describes the proscribed organisations that we're to be mindful of when we're taking bookings. So that's the legislation that we look at. There's also National Venue Managers Network, who basically discuss all the shows that are on these circuits, so that if there are any issues that have taken place on the first night of a tour, that other venues that are on those tour schedules are aware of those issues in advance so that you can react accordingly. Then there's the actual artist reputation, content, social media, so that we know if what they're claiming the show to be about is accurate. And also from a profitability angle, so that we know whether the show is sort of worthy or is going to be a success. So that's quite an important thing for us as well. We look if they've booked with us before, we look at the profile, we look at the standing of the companies that are putting these acts forward, and look at alternative acts on their roster to see if the quality of the production is going to be good enough to be in the town hall. And then we look at our diary to see if there's anything else that is of a similar nature to stop one from selling well against the other. Once then that takes place, we've done all our research and all the benchmarking, we make contact with the promoter. If the dates work with the tour schedules, then we'll confirm a date, put a pencil in the diary. We send out a venue booking form, which basically it identifies needs for the promoters, confirms dates, times. Once that's signed, that acts as a legal contract until the contract is actually confirmed. And that then, once the contract is signed, after that covers things like financial indemnity, confirmation of deal and financial arrangements, responsibilities for the artist, including safeguarding of young people, our responsibilities, which is similar to the above, making sure there's any risk assessments in place if it's required, marketing, any cancellations, recording of performances, smoking, the reservation of the right to stop performance under contravention of any national legislation that I talked about earlier, and what would happen in the event of cancellation. After that then, the event is advertised and included in our brochure, which goes to 20,000 people, roughly, and in that includes things like the content of the performance, age range, suitability, who it's aimed at, and any blurb that the artist wants to put in there to kind of promote themselves. We then advertise that as well on social media and comms. If there's anything that
like for example, comedians generally tend to have an age range, so we would put in any age suitability so that we don't have young people attending if it's, for example, a comedian who likes a lot of adult language, if you will. Performance takes place, again, under those legislative bodies we have the power to cancel the performance. When the performance takes place, we would have at least two technical staff backstage that are making the performance happen from a professional perspective, but they also have the right to pull the artist off stage if they wish to, as well as a front of house manager that would deal with the safety of the public that are in attendance. When the performance takes place, then we then also send out feedback to all of our customers to find out whether they enjoyed it, what we did, what we could do better, and then those considerations are noted if they are touring again in a future schedule. The hires procedure is slightly different because that's more of a reaction to people coming to us. We do advertise to try and get our spaces sold, but that is far more through a reactive process. At the point when a company contacts us to inquire about availability, we then discuss quite a few requirements. Again, I'll do it quickly, sorry to keep repeating going here. But numbers attending, room required, contact details, which is actually very key because there's normally three or four exchanges before a hire is confirmed, which, again, if there was anything that could be suspicious, things like having proper contact details, proper email addresses, bank details for when we're confirming the actual contracts. Again, these are things that stop kind of any duplicity from people trying to hire our spaces. We ask how they found out about us, if they have any catering and equipment requirements. We supply them with a quote. We then meet them in person to show them the room so they know what to expect, and so to assess any risks or any needs that they'll have when they attend. Pencil the diary off in the date. We draw up a contract which is signed by me or our business and operations manager. It also allows a two-fold process so that we have the people that are organising the actual contract to take place and then the people signing off as two different entities to allow this sort of two-tier security blanket, if you like, about the stuff that's going in. The contracts then, like I say, it's drawn up. We have seven different contracts due to the variety of the different events that we have. The contract that is sent out in the end, though, all includes the same set of terms and conditions, which is also includes the statement, which is that the manager reserves the right to refuse or cancel any booking, particularly where groups or individuals are found to have been dishonest about the remit of their organisation and the purpose of the booking, or if the hire is considered by the manager to be a proscribed organisation under the Terrorism Act 2000, or to be acting for or on behalf of such an organisation. The contract signed, confirmed, we then get a deposit invoice, and then once the event's confirmed, we get the settlement for the event, and then we contact them for feedback post-event. I think that's the process in its entirety. You want to sum up, Sylvia?
Yeah, I think obviously there are quite a lot of forms, quite a lot of procedures, quite a lot of checks and balances in there, and so from start to finish it's a very complex process, and basically all the different staff need to know where their role is and what level they're operating on. We just wanted to kind of give you a flavour of and talk you through that process. Basically, it means that staff can't just operate in isolation or ignore legislation or ignore the kind of checks and balances that are put in there. And basically, staff need to follow those procedures. And if they weren't following those procedures, potentially we could take disciplinary action if that needed to be the case. But we feel that because we review them on a regular basis, that they're robust and fit for purpose, and like Robbie said, we actually look at benchmarking best practice to make sure that we're operating with the correct procedures in place.
Well, thank you very much. I'll come to you in a minute, Renata. Well, we're actually thank you very much for that, and wow, that's a lot of paperwork, a lot of talking. You did very well there, thank you very much. The idea of it now coming is to decide whether that is indeed a robust procedure to follow, and I believe that, isn't it, that we're deciding on now.
Yeah, so the purpose of is for members tonight is to decide if they've got enough information, you've listened to Sylvia and Robbie, and do you now feel it's appropriate to have a scrutiny review of this area, or do you feel that you've heard enough tonight and you've listened to the quite robust procedures that are in place? Do you feel that it needs to be looked at further? So that's what the decision is before you tonight.
Thank you. Renata.
Thank you. Not wishing to, Councillor Jones, for the benefit of the tape, not wishing to draw this out and take away from that important decision. I do have a question I'll have to build up to, if I hopefully don't keep us too long, which may help make that decision. I also thank the officers for that very detailed response of the process, but it just does leave me with this slight little question, and I thank Councillor Parton for raising the issue to bring this question to my mind. My very limited understanding of this particular genre and audience is that spiritualism is recognised in the UK as a religion, whereas legally psychics, who are part and parcel of that religion, have to class themselves as being for entertainment only. And I think that duality there, specifically for that audience, is in itself a bone of contention, I believe. Which brings me on to I haven't seen this, as Councillor Parton said, in the Town Hall events brochure. I believe we used to get that routinely on issue in our pigeonholes, so it'd be nice to reinstate that, because I haven't seen the last one for a little while, so maybe that's fell by the wayside. I think the real question here is, I'm glad to hear all those commercial processes are in place, but I think the real question is it commercial viability, or is it that versus public perception and the potential to cause offence? And is that really the issue that Councillor Parton's kind of leading us here to think about and debate? And I know there was a recent case where that kind of in another silo of the council, in terms of our market traders, where there was a lot of debate as to whether items for sale should be for sale or not, and what the council's involvement in that may be. So I suppose my real question, which I am getting too honest, in all of those very detailed and processes you have, is there a focus group or a test market sense check in terms of the potential to cause offence conducted in terms of the acts before booking or as part of the booking process?
Robbie Kerr. So when we meet, we have the entirety of our programme marketing team and I, we sit down and we talk those things through. Taste and offence is a very difficult thing to be an arbiter of. We're about to have a man dressed as a woman on stage for 6 weeks in our pantomime. Some people might find that offensive. It's not really my place, I think, to say exactly what that is. What our mandate is, I think, is to provide a commercial programme that fits within legal, financial and safeguarding parameters, and we work within that. With regards again to Sally Morgan, she was advertised as entertainment online and through in person and over the phone and everything we could do. And I take Councillor Parton's point about the whether it's a religion or whether it's entertainment, because that's a very interesting point. We took it from the perspective of what we would advertise as, and in terms of when we went out and spoke to the, you know, we spoke to the audiences, we had no complaints in terms of any feeling of duplicity of what the artist was doing. I think, promoted it as well as we could to say exactly what it was and that it wasn't for the for the purpose of entertainment. Some people may feel differently, but that is, of course, what opinion is.
Sorry, if I can just go back, revisit my question slightly, and sorry if I wasn't quite clear. I take the point, I don't want that labour of decision making on your shoulders, but is there a focus group by which we run these through at all as part of the general process to get that kind of feedback?
I think Robbie's explained that the actual booking of events is quite, it's an operational element, and the staff are well trained and versed and know all the current legislation, know the business inside out. In terms of if there's a focus group, no, there isn't a focus group that operates to support the town hall, but the staff work as a team to kind of do those checks and balances as part of that process. I'm going to hand back to Robbie to explain the kind of timing of booking events, because I think that's an important factor here.
Yeah, I mean, we do have some shows that could take, we do have some shows that could take a couple of weeks to actually nail down, but also we have a lot of shows, and we're very fortunate that by increasing our capacity to being just over 500, we now get considered for tier two events, which is venues from 500 to 1,000. What that does mean, though, is that the turnaround time for those becomes incredibly tight, because instead of us getting, we would have, for example, even today, Russell Watson just confirmed, he's doing 1,500s, 2,000s all around the country, but because of partially our reputation and partially because of our ability to negotiate and tie down quickly that deal to get the show confirmed and booked in our diary, we're able to be included on national, really popular tours. It does mean that we meet very quickly and go through that. Shows of that magnitude, generally there isn't much room about whether something would be considered offensive or not. But the nature of the fact that most things are on a circuit means that a lot of people have already kind of taken that decision already. We don't produce ourselves, we're a receiving house. So what that means is that we pick up a circuit that has been in existence for a long time. Because of the size we are, we're sort of middle tier before lower events coming up and bigger events coming down. And we don't have that decision to make generally, because it's been made as part of a circuit for things that are bigger or smaller, public and private sector as well. It's not as though we are alone in when we book these acts in. They are part of a circuit that would cover pretty much every single status of venue that exists.
So, right. Do you feel adding potentially a focus group could mean that we miss out on some of these circuits from visiting
absolutely
out of town as elongating the process?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Right. Okay.
Right.
Thank you, Chair.
Ted, you wanted to come back, and Luke, at the moment we are deciding whether you think it's a robust method already, a robust process, or whether you think it should come to a scrutiny panel. Yeah.
If I may be particularly difficult, Michael Hopkins.
No, you'd be difficult.
I think it's you're probably not even doing that. You're just saying, having heard what you've heard,
are you happy?
As you said right at the very beginning, do you think there's an issue here that needs scrutinising?
Have you ever had a problem before?
Never one. Never one. And I think that we go to such lengths and go to real detailed mind information before we make a lot of those decisions that we kind of are aware of what the reactions would be in 99.9% of the cases. We've never once had a question about suitability. We've never once had a question about whether we've led anyone in a certain direction.
Thank you. I don't really want to your question was a very long one,
sorry,
Ms. Jones, Councillor Jones, so I don't really want to make this any longer than it is. I myself personally am quite satisfied that it is a robust procedure already, and I don't think hearing about it warrants further scrutiny. But that is my opinion as the chair. Sorry, I've got two others if I ask you.
No, I'm chair, Councillor Parton. I'm quite happy for other members to speak.
Okay. Right, so I want to just ask the question. Do you think it should be added to the group's scrutiny work?
Personally, no, Chair.
Right. Thank you. It's a yes or a no.
Yeah. I feel the need to justify it.
No,
with just one
sentence.
Yes, Chair, please.
No.
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 It should be.
My answer is no. May I amplify that? Because I was consulted about this a little while ago. I thought I ought to explain myself. May I do that?
I've just denied one doing it.
So,
Luke?
No.
No. Right, so the consensus of opinion here is that
We feel as though the process you are following at the moment is robust, and with the knowledge that nothing has ever happened before, and this particular entertainer was entertainment, I'm quite happy. Thank you very much. So, I'm sorry to shut everybody down, but that was what we were talking about today.
Right, so for the recording, Karen Widdowson, thank you very much. I'm now going to talk about the rest of the work programme, so you're quite welcome to leave at this point.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the therapy for coming.
Okay, so you have the work programme items. So you will note in the report that SNB on the 25th of October made three changes, and you are asked to note those changes. They're set down in the bullet points as three changes there. Also, you've had a copy of the updated notice of key decisions. Is there anything that you would like picking up from those key decisions?
Okay.
No.
I have, along with Councillor Harris, been through the key decisions, albeit very quickly, but there wasn't anything there that sprang to mind for us. For our next meeting in February, we have now got three. Or is it four?
I was going to say when we look to the. Page 5, which starts with the February meeting. So we've got the corporate antisocial behaviour policy, performance scrutiny panel update, the homelessness and review of the homelessness strategy, review of the council's current policies and procedures in relation to the methods of conducting surveys and consultations. And I've also been asked to add in two additional items as well. One is from the planning enforcement plan, which is due to go to Cabinet in March. So there is a suggestion that's added to the work programme for February. So this is making your agenda item for February quite heavy at the present time, but I think that would be a good one to add on. And also Alison Simmons would like the private sector housing enforcement policy adding on, as that is also going to Cabinet in March. And so it would be a good opportunity for this group to consider that item as well. So we've got the items that are listed on pages 5 and 6, so that's for February, plus those two additional items.
Thank you.
So are you in agreement with those?
Yes.
Yeah.
Good.
Thank you.
And also the report sets out some further comments that were received from Alison Simmons regarding, you can see those three bullet points about the tenancy strategy, houses in multiple occupation, and the licensing policy for houses in multiple occupation. So I think that's the items scheduled, you know, anything else that anybody wants to discuss on the work programme?
No.
No? Okay, thank you. That's
my
comment.
Just whether you wish to capture the thoughts that was raised earlier on in the meeting about the at your next meeting, the chair of the performance panel will go to come. Did you want to use that as an opportunity to discuss that interrelationship between the two of you in terms of when things in strategy should be monitored, and in going back the other way, when the performance suggests that a policy needs to be reviewed?
Possibly, but it depends on the meeting that we're having. The chairs are all having a meeting early next week. So could I get back to you on that?
Yeah.
Okay. Just as a footnote, the homelessness policy, Alison Simmons asked the committee to make suggestions, I believe, make suggestions of the layout of the homeless strategy. I did reply to that, and I'm hoping that others did as well to add to that. Yes,
I can, Chair. I printed off
wealth of information that's about this thick. For the benefits of the tape, that's probably about 2 inches thick. So I'm still reading and digesting through those three plans and the linked government policy document. But there was a good source of information there, and I shall endeavour to be back as soon as I've managed to wade through it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much for coming. Date of next meeting is
the 6th of February.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much, Ian. And I'm sorry.